Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah News Week in Review from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, alfalfa in the spotlight, why one crop uses more than half of Utah's water, and how that relates to the plight of the Great Salt Lake, among other things. Mosquitoes, as predicted, are wreaking havoc at the new state prison out by the lake, but addressing the problem could cause harm to the already stressed ecosystem. And state-approved coyote killing contests, that is, in Utah, stir controversy. Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. And George, as always, thanks for being here.
You bet. Good morning.
Good morning. On the Zoom, Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins joins us. Welcome back, Peyton.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. Good morning. And public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Hi there, Brian.
Hey, Roger. Good to be here.
Thanks very much for joining. Listeners, you can join as well with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. The handle is at KCPW. Or call us up, 801-355-8255 is the number. That's 801-355-TALK. And it seems like we're going to spend the whole of our show situated outside with the stories that we're covering today. And we talk a lot about water on this program. I want to begin with the deep dive into the crop that uses more than half of Utah's water. This is alfalfa, Brian. Brian Maffley, public lands and environment reporter. What was the genesis of this report that you and your colleague Mark Eddington did? Why this deep dive on alfalfa?
Yeah. Leah Larson is also involved, and as is our photographer Trent Nelson. It's a group effort. So this was instigated by Grant Birmingham, our editor, who really felt, I think a lot of us do, that hey, if we're going to be talking about getting out of this water crisis that's facing the state, then we need to look at the elephant in the room, which is agriculture, which accounts for, according to the state's own numbers, 82% of the water, 82% of the state's water resources. So we wanted to figure out, well, you know, alfalfa is the number one crop in Utah, which is used to feed livestock and dairy cows. Turns out a lot of it is exported to China and other countries in Asia.
Right.
And so, you know, we thought, let's, visit the farms, learn more about how it's processed and what kind of things can be done to, reduce the amount of water that's needed to sustain that crop. One of the things I want to emphasize is the Tribune really isn't, suggesting that we dry out these farms. They cover, they account for most of the 1 million irrigated acres in Utah. But as a kind of a thought experiment, we're trying to ask, well, what would happen if those farms did go away? And that it would probably have a pretty devastating impact on a lot of parts of rural Utah.
Right. I mean, and we can get to the sort of also what would happen to the land if the farms went away. But I mean, okay. So your article, for this story, you visited some of those farms, alfalfa and hay farms, and this is a, as you said, extremely water intensive crop. And we can get to the actual numbers. I mean, something like 2/3 of all water that is used in Utah is on hay or alfalfa. But what does how does this, when you go out and look at a farm and the watering that's happening for alfalfa, what does that actually look like?
Well, a lot of it, some of it is done with, highly efficient pivots where the water is under pressure and then applied in a fairly efficient manner. But in most cases, it's flood irrigation. It's very inefficient. It's totally unmetered. It's a lot of that water doesn't actually reach the crop. Some of it just flows off without doing any good. And that said, I mean, it's worth noting that, if a farmer is putting, 100 acre feet of water on his farm every year, a lot of that water is just going to wind up back in the river, so it's not like the water is, put on the, goes down the canal.
Sure.
And that's the end of it. A lot of it winds up back in the system. So it'll get used a few times. And hey, maybe if we're lucky, some of it winds up in the Great Salt Lake or the Colorado River.
Hmm.
But the fact is, it's a lot of it's gone. It just evaporates.
Right. Evaporates. I mean, I guess the crop itself obviously takes up some of the water. And then if you're shipping off the crop to, you know, to China, then you're shipping off some portion of your water to China with it, right? Yeah. Or is that wrong?
So, yeah, no, that's true. We're basically, this has been a controversy around the West as the phenomenon of alfalfa exports. The two main recipients are Saudi Arabia and China. And a lot of people look at this and say, look, we this is like exporting our water to these countries to support their agriculture. Shouldn't that alfalfa be supporting our own livestock and dairy operators here? I'm sure there's plenty of dairies in Idaho and Utah that would be very pleased to take that alfalfa that's going off to China. Hmm. That's a policy question that will be the subject of additional reporting by me and Leah and Mark.
Okay. This article that you wrote draws on the sort of expertise or the evaluation that a University of Utah economics professor did, and there are others who we can get to in your story, but this is Gabriel Lozada, and he talks about, you know, the idea that we could put this water to better use, but it would require untangling this knot of water law, and that's a really hard knot to untie, right?
That calling it a knot is exactly right. Hmm. It's very difficult to untie, and it is basically the Utah water law is probably the main obstacle to changing the way, you know, to incentivize water conservation. I mean, basically, Utah water law, as in other Western states, creates large incentives to use as much water as you're entitled to, regardless of whether it actually grows anything. And then there are no, and then the disincentivizes conservation. So in other words, if you can grow just as much alfalfa with half as much water, then you wind up putting at risk your right to use that other half of the water. So you have this huge incentive to not conserve. Now I want to back up to Gabriel Lozada's study. So he and many others have been kind of frustrated with the state for not really doing adequate inventories about how much water is used by which sectors of Utah agriculture.
Yeah.
And so what he did, so he came up by analyzing existing databases, estimates of how much water is used by different crops in Utah. And unfortunately, this water isn't, you know, it's not metered, and it's, you know, very difficult to actually say how much water is used. So what he did was he looked at other studies that showed how much water is needed to grow alfalfa in particular counties, and crunched a lot of numbers, and he came up with this figure that, you know, two-thirds of the 5 million acres of acre feet of water that's diverted in Utah goes to alfalfa or other types of hay.
Yeah.
That's a staggering number, you know.
Yeah. Hard to, I mean, two-thirds is a number, but if you look at there's a chart in your article that shows crop types, you know, on Utah farms and how much water is being used on each, and hay and alfalfa is just this huge Pac-Man sized piece of the pie. It's got, you know, a slightly open mouth of a Pac-Man eating the rest of them is the way that it looks to me. And it's just a way of visualizing it. And I think that people, that's by Christopher Charrington, a Salt Lake Tribune, graphics expert. But so check that out at Brian's article at sltrip.com. But I guess, is there a way to think about how much water is used in alfalfa and in agriculture in general versus the economic impact of that industry? I mean, if you separate the land out and you don't talk about the fact that it is this open space that is being at least maintained as something like open space, what is the economic sort of driver of hay and alfalfa versus other industries in the state of Utah?
Well, you know, according to Gabriel Lozada's study, it's fairly insignificant, but that's looking at it a pretty stingy way. So the value of the hay harvested in Utah last year, which was a peak year because of high prices, was about $500 million. And that represents you know, 0.2 to 0.3% of Utah's GDP. So, that compares favorably, or with the cash receipts from amusement parks. That was Grant's contribution to the story. But I think, like, if you look at it in that term, those terms, I think that's kind of unfair, because that alfalfa is kind of like the bedrock of Utah's agriculture. It's often called the lifeblood of rural Utah, and I think that's a fair way to characterize it, because that alfalfa that is grown, a lot of it is grown by ranchers who then use it to sustain their operations. So that product they're creating is helping drive the rest of Utah's agricultural economy. Hmm. Now, that calculus kind of disappears when you export it. But that said, it's like we've talked to economists who said, look, yeah, sure, these farmers, these dairy operators and livestock guys could get their alfalfa elsewhere if Utah stops growing it. However, they would have to truck it in from out of state. It'll increase their costs. It'll be a hardship on those producers. But then the other part of it is, well, these folks who grow, there's as many as 10,000 farms that grow alfalfa in Utah. They grow alfalfa. They support their communities in various ways. And so if you take that away, that'll have a huge impact on the character of rural Utah. And I wanted to say, the folks we profiled in our story last week, they represent family farms.
Yeah.
Not all alfalfa producers are family operators who work, 50 to 150 acres. Some of them are big corporate operators who have farms, spread over entire valleys, and they're not, you can't call them family farmers. We're trying to figure out, like, how much of our alfalfa production comes from family farms, how much from these big operations who tend to export.
Okay.
That's going to be part of our ongoing reporting. That's going to be spread out over the next few months and probably into next spring's growing season.
What about, Brian, just, I think people listening will have this question, and I want to ask it for that reason, which is, what about transitioning or creating mechanisms by which the state or whoever, as a society, we could help these farmers transition to less thirsty crops while still maintaining their land? Is that, I know that it's crazy to move away from alfalfa if you're a farmer from an economic standpoint. It's apparently very easy and very has other sort of benefits for the soil we can talk about too, but according to some of the people you spoke with. But yeah, what about mechanisms to move people from this water, this very water heavy utilizing crop?
Yeah. Well, for starters, the state is very actively subsidizing the installation of water efficiency measures. There's a grant program to quote unquote optimize water use in Utah agriculture, and that's going to result in some water savings. Now, about transitioning to other crops, Mark Eddington spoke to some growers who explained the challenges of transitioning to something else, because a lot of these farmers are working fairly small farms, 160 acre quarter section or less. And at that scale, transitioning to something else means buying all sorts of new equipment, rejiggering your irrigation in ways that might not make sense for a smaller operation. For something larger, well, then it does make sense. So those crops you transition to, might not grow as well at our elevations with our climactic variability. That's the beauty of alfalfa, is it grows in all sorts of different conditions. You don't have to keep replanting it. You don't need to fertilize it as much. It actually nourishes the soil because it's a legume. It fixes, like, peas and beans and whatever.
Fixes nitrogen.
So it fixes nitrogen at the end of the soil. So when you rotate your crops with something else, well, then you don't have to use fertilizer for those other crops. So in a lot of ways, it makes total sense to grow alfalfa in Utah, especially when you don't have to pay for the water, which is
the case. Right. That, yeah. This is part of your story. It's kind of the crux of your story to me, the whole thing, which is that farmers aren't paying for their water. Really, they're paying for canal upkeep. They're by paying for a price per share in these canal companies. Tell us about that, Brian.
The water itself, So most of the growers are members of irrigation and canal companies, and they hold shares in those companies. And so the amount of water you get is based on your shares. And, you know, it'll vary from year to year, depending on the availability of water and the seniority of your water right. And so what farmers will do is, generally speaking, they'll use as much water as they're entitled to, whether or not they actually need it. But in the last, you know, several years of drought, they need every drop they can get for the most part. And anyway, I got distracted there. Roger, repeat your question.
Oh, just the fact that, I mean, basically they're not paying for the water itself. Yeah. And that means that they don't really think about wasting it.
Yeah. Well, you've taken away one of the incentives to reduce your use. If it doesn't save you any money to cut your water use, you'd be a fool not to use your full share. So yeah, that's part of what's going to have to change with water law, is to create ways to reward farmers to use less water, and then to make that water available for something other than agriculture. Like, you know, replenishing the Great Salt Lake, for example. Utah Rivers Council has done one study that, you know, it's going to take 1 million+ acre feet of water a year to restore the Great Salt Lake to health. That's a lot of water, but it's doable if we can grow the alfalfa with, say, half as much water as they're doing now. That could get us most of the way there,
I see that. But I see your point, meaning that you have to change the incentive, because if right now the incentive is use it or lose it and use as much as you can, then you're going to do that.
There is no solution without changing aligning the incentives with conservation. Right now the incentives are aligned against conservation, and for years the legislature has been struggling with this question. It's not like they've turned a blind eye to it. It's just that someone's going to have, there'll be winners and losers in all of this, and who wants to be the loser? And agriculture gets a lot of, they have a lot of influence in for better or worse, they have a lot of influence in the legislature. And I just want to emphasize that, you know, we're not out here, you know, wagging our fingers at agricultural users. They're an important part of our state's economy, whether, you know, regardless of how puny. I mean, agriculture helps characterize these communities in rural Utah that in positive ways. It's just that it's coming at a cost, and we need to appreciate those costs as we have these discussions.
Sure.
But I guess, you know, I've heard a lot of feedback from our stories that we posted. It's like, gee, why do we keep, letting farmers get away with this? And I get kind of concerned that people want to think that we can just take the water from agriculture to solve our problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we're urban Utahns use a ridiculous amount of water in their homes. I want to turn the tables a little bit. I mean, on average, Utahns use 180 gallons per day for residential use, according to the Department of Natural Resources. That's the state's numbers. Now, so that's the water we're using in our homes and in our yards. That is like 3 to 4 times what people use in California. Hmm. There's so much room for urban Utahns to improve their water use. So I think it's like kind of hypocritical for people to, to accuse agricultural producers of wasting water.
Sure.
When there's, there's improvements for everybody to make.
Improvements for everybody to make. Maybe that's a point to bring in editorial page editor George Pyle here. I mean, I think that, George, one of the things that Brian's talking about is this idea that there's a, you know, we're going to pit rural versus urban, and, you know, you solve one problem, and there's various problems that need to be solved together. I do, though, think that there is this emergency in the idea that we're going to have a dried up lake bed, and the, you know, if you go to the old, you know, the good of the many, you've got a whole bunch of people who are going to be impacted by, say, really bad air quality as a result. I don't know, George, I'll let you, why don't I let you expound? What's your answer to the water problem in Utah, George? Go.
Well, first, thank you to Brian and his colleagues for doing this, because I've been not knowing what to think about this for a long time. And you hear all the time, our overuse of water is mostly on agriculture, and it isn't metered and it isn't charged, and we don't even know how much water we're using. And so how can you change your behavior if you don't even know what your behavior is? So that's been part of the problem. And also, I know a little bit about agriculture from work I've done in the past. I was not aware that alfalfa was one of those crops that fixes nitrogen in the soil, which is important if you use any kind of crop rotation, which a lot of industrial agriculture is sadly getting away from. You don't have to plant it as often. You can get several crops out of it. When you don't have to plant it so often, then you get a root system that holds the soil in place. Those are all good things that there's too little of in modern American agriculture. The problem is it just uses so bloody much water, especially the way we have it set up and priced and the way we do the water rights. And, I mean, not all alfalfa farms in the state are upstream of the Great Salt Lake, but many of them are. And we are probably going to have to get to a point, we definitely are going to have to get to a point where we do one of two things. We start to meter this water and charge by the gallon or acre foot used so that there is an incentive to use less. And it's silly to blame, as Brian has said, it's silly to blame the farmers and say it's all their fault. They are responding to the market cues. Yeah. They can sell alfalfa, the water's free or cheap. You have rights. If you don't, the rights are use it or lose it. We have, you know, grabbed the farmers by the lapels and told them to do this. Mm-hmm. Use a whole lot of water, grow some alfalfa, use a little of it yourself, ship a bunch of it to China.
Make money.
The market is telling them to do that. So, of course, they're going to do that. What we need to do is put our thumb on the scale a little bit and change the market, one, by making it cost them money to use all this water, and they're smart. They'll figure out how to adapt. And if adapting means don't grow alfalfa at all, then they'll adapt. Working for a newspaper that used to be a license to make money in every town in America, and now we're struggling to survive, I have kind of not quite so much sympathy for people who say, hey, the world is passing me by, the economy is changing, the rules are changing. Hey, what about the way I've lived for 50 years? Hmm. Isn't that worth something? Well, ask a taxi company, ask a record store, ask all kinds of businesses out there. The world changes, and you need to adapt. I do also think that, you know, setting up a system where we meter this water and charge for it, that's going to take time. That's going to take money. I think the state needs to start looking at just buying or leasing some of these water rights, giving these farmers money so that they don't go broke because they've been caught in this situation where the world has changed and they can't. And it would be worth it to the state, I think, to go up and find some of these places. And it's always been a joke in agriculture. We pay farmers not to grow wheat and not to grow corn. It's the system. Because if you grow too much, the price goes down.
Yeah.
And you're trying to do price supports. And it might be nice for the state to come along and target some of these places, especially that do take water out of the Great Salt Lake or take water out of the Colorado River, and say it is worth it to us as a state, because we don't want the lake to dry up and blow toxic dust all over Salt Lake City. Here's some money. Don't use the water. And figure out a fair price for this, because it's not the farmer's fault that this situation exists.
Brian, could a bill be passed which simply says you can let your water flow down and we'll pay you for it, and that's that? I mean, I guess you change the incentives on water. There needs to be something like conservation easements to allow for the land to remain open space where it needs to be, so it's not all being converted into subdivisions immediately. But is there a sort of more quick emergency fix that can be done right now?
Yeah, there is, but it's complicated. And so last legislative session, Representative Ferry, who's now the director of Department of Natural Resources, did sponsor a bill to try to accomplish what you're talking about right now. And Leah Larson, our colleague, is looking into whether or not farmers actually took advantage of those incentives. And it was called the In-Stream Flow Act or something like that, where they created a way to, allow farmers to forego their use of a particular water right and then gain some kind of compensation for that and let the water run down the river. Olden times that was considered waste. Now it's considered environmental stewardship. There's been a sea change in how we think of water flowing into the Great Salt Lake these days. But however, that bill that Joel Ferry sponsored was kind of considered baby steps toward a larger solution. And those kind of that kind of big picture thinking will definitely get a lot of attention in the upcoming legislative sessions, maybe the next several legislative sessions, that would set up a way for farmers to get compensated for the water that they're not the water right that they're not using, but then not risk losing that water right. That's the big rub here, is that if you don't, the way the law works is if you don't use that water, you lose the right to it, and it'll get used by somebody, another farmer, and perhaps in the the same valley where you are, or just downstream. There's no guarantee that water would be allowed to run into the Great Salt Lake or the Colorado River.
Without
some substantial change in the law that will allow those water rights to be put to use for something else. It's an incredibly complicated picture, and it would take entire years worth of behind the headlines to really figure out. And I want to plug in our reporting, I discovered a podcast called Ripple Effect it's hosted by a Utah water attorney named Emily Lewis.
That's great.
I learned so much from following that podcast. I highly recommend it. Emily and her guests get into these very questions we're talking about right now.
Yeah. They are with Clyde Snow, and it's called Ripple Effect. You can check that out on the internet. However, all of the coverage that we have been discussing about this really important story, I can't actually recommend it enough. It's reporting by Brian Maffley, Mark Eddington, Leah Larson, Grant Birmingham, and others. It is called One Crop Uses More Than Half of Utah's Water. Here's Why. You can find it at sltrip.com. There's also a quiz on alfalfa and water use in Utah that you can find there as well. But Brian, thank you very much for telling us about this. We need to head to a break. It's we've taken up, as you said, a chunk of the show, and we could keep talking about it and certainly will keep talking about it for some time to come. Thanks again for your reporting. When we come back, we will stay outside and actually near the Great Salt Lake as well. We will talk about mosquitoes wreaking havoc out at the new state prison and what should and perhaps shouldn't be done about it. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Peyton Harkins and Brian Maffley, and by editorial page editor George Pyle. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. The handle is at KCPW, or by calling us up at 801-355-8255. Peyton Harkins, to you now, and we've kept you on hold for a while. Thanks for hanging on here, for your patience. You've done a couple of reports on the topic that we're going to turn to now, which is mosquitoes, which they are feasting on inmates out at the new state prison, apparently, and on staff and guards and visitors, or have been, maybe not today with the snowstorm. How bad is the problem? Just kind of give us the sort of explanation of how serious the mosquito infestation is out there.
Sure. Yeah. So basically, I mean, the area out there where they decided to put the prison is an area that, you know, it is a wetland, it is a marsh, it is perfect sort of mosquito breeding ground, because, you know, it is by nature full of, you know, low, shallow water that mosquitoes like to breed in. And so this year, there's actually more mosquitoes out there than they've seen sort of in the last 5 years, and maybe even before then. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with just sort of how long it was hot this season. You know, we were having 100 degree days all the way up, I think, through September. You know, this was kind of an uncharacteristically warm, summer into fall. And so because of that, it's like, you know, the peak of mosquito season is normally sort of midsummer, you know, like June, July, August. But in this case, it was like you had the mosquitoes that you'd normally have sort of in the normal months, and then that sort of bled into September and also some into October. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, they're seeing tens of thousands of mosquitoes when crews are checking traps and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, previously this wasn't, you know, a huge issue because there weren't so many people out there. You know, recently they've been doing some development out there with, you know, the Amazon distribution warehouses and other stuff like that. But, you know, that's a different sort of issue than when you move people out there and they're confined in this area, you know. And so the summer when they moved the prisoners out there, you know, that was 4,000 more people than there used to be in that area, and these people can't leave, you know. And so you have the mosquitoes that are always there, and this influx of people for them to eat off of, essentially.
Right. And I know one person in your story is quoted as saying, like, there's all this carbon dioxide which people are emitting, and that draws the mosquitoes in because they are attracted to it. And I'm realizing I use the word infestation to start with, and it's sort of maybe the wrong word because this is just their habitat. It's where they lived. It's where the state decided to put this prison. And this was a problem, the idea that there would be mosquitoes that would have a significant impact. It was a problem that the state was aware of when they made the decision to move the prison, right?
Yes, it was. You know, you go back and look at some of the documents that the Prison Relocation Commission put together. And yeah, I mean, this is a bullet point in the charts they put together. And it's interesting because, you know, at the other sites that they could have chosen, you know, pests were not an issue, but they knew that it was going to be an issue at this site. And they even put a price tag on it. It was like 160K they thought it would take to mitigate the mosquitoes, and then it would be habitable. But that was just a cost they were willing to incur because they, you know, thought that, you know, based on several different factors, this was the best place for the prison.
Okay, I was going to ask. I mean, I remember asking the question at the time, which is why put a prison where in a place with such, you know, significant mosquito activity? But I guess those other factors were, I'm assuming redevelopment dollars played into it too. But there was construction that happened out there, and I know that part of your story is about the fact that construction workers actually didn't sort of suffer the way that the inmates are suffering. And I guess, is that just because of the amount of people out there, or was there mosquito abatement happening during construction? Also, abatement is kind of a funny word. Maybe you can tell us what that really means.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, abatement is just basically getting rid of something. And so, like, the, you know, Salt Lake City has its own mosquito abatement district. Magna has its own mosquito abatement district. And so they're responsible for putting out traps and kind of, you know, analyzing how many mosquitoes are in the area and sort of how they need to counteract that issue. And so, you know, in Salt Lake, that's a lot of, at least who I talk to, it's a lot of, you know, they do larvicides, which target, you know, the larva of the mosquitoes. Then they do these adulticides, which target the adult mosquitoes. And so anyway,
I piggybacked two questions there together. The first was mosquitoes apparently weren't a big deal during construction of the state prison. Is that true?
They were sort of a deal. I mean, you look at sort of the story that we did around when the groundbreaking happened in June. And, you know, part of the reason the prison was delayed was because of cost and, you know, all the issues everybody was having with construction. But also, you know, they had foundational issues because they're building on a wetland, you know. And then they did mention in that story that, you know, buggy weather also, or buggy conditions also sort of plagued these construction workers. But, you know, there were fewer of them out there. So that point you made earlier about, you know, emitting CO or CO2 from us, you know, humans, yeah, that wasn't as much of an issue. And also, you know, when I was doing this reporting, I requested contracts for mosquito abatement services and found out that they did have a contract with Salt Lake City Mosquito Abatement Services to do, you know, kind of extra mitigation out there for construction crews. But that contract actually lapsed before inmates moved in, and they haven't figured out a new one yet.
How bad is it, I mean, for the inmates who are out there right now in terms of, I want to get to the questions about using pesticides out by the lake and other environmental concerns, but how bad is it? I mean, how are they suffering? I mean, I know you have spoken with people who are family members of inmates who have, mm-hmm, who really are complaining about this, saying this is a serious issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. So, I mean, from what I've been hearing, people, you know, we're talking about literal, like, tiny blood splatters all over the walls every day, you know, from where mosquitoes would get in, and inmates or, you know, staff or whoever would swat them. And then there would just be little blood splatters on the wall, and, you know, maybe clean them off. And then the next little bit, they're back. You know, I've heard of people who are, you know how some people, it's like, you know, aren't bothered by mosquitoes, yeah, as much. And then other people, you know, seem to be. So it's like those people, you know, they're covered, you know, with big bumps and stuff all over their arms. People, you know, in the middle of summer choosing to wear long sleeve t-shirts and stuff like that in order to kind of stave off mosquitoes, or socks when they sleep and stuff like that, just trying to do whatever they can to, you know, prevent the mosquitoes from biting them. But there's only so much you can do, you know, I mean, they're pesky, you know, they didn't have bug spray. They still don't have bug spray. And so, yeah, I think the image that stuck with me, though, was just this idea of literal blood on the wall. And, you know, I heard from some loved ones that, you know, they, you know, one of the sort of attractive features of this new prison was that inmates would have more access to, you know, the outdoors and natural sunlight and stuff like that. But with the mosquitoes, it's almost like that's become an issue in itself, because anytime they go outside for yard time or to walk to the, you know, cafeteria, it's like they're getting swarmed. And so some inmates are choosing, you know, to stay indoors, or they're choosing to, you know, not go to the cafeteria to get meals, is what I've been hearing, just so they don't get bitten.
Wow. I'm just gonna make a quick comment on those people who have won the genetic lottery and don't taste good to mosquitoes. Those people don't know how lucky they are. I wanna insult them. Yeah, one of them is my coworker. But so, just, you know, you talked about mosquito abatement, the larvicides and adulticides, as opposed to, like, adolescenticides or but adulticides. I mean, these are pesticides that are, there's a contract in the works with the Salt Lake City Mosquito Abatement District to, I guess, try and deal with the problem. However, I know there are some people who are concerned about the use of these pesticides out by the prison. And maybe, leaving aside the kind of wetlands and the impact there, can we first ask, maybe I'll ask this question that you may or may not be able to answer, which is, are these pesticides, are they safe for the inmates, for the people in general in that area? Can pesticide use out by the prison, or anywhere for that matter, be considered safe?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the EPA and the Salt Lake City Mosquito Abatement District would certainly say so. You know, the EPA provides a certain guidelines that the Mosquito Abatement District has to use. And, you know, talking to officials at the Mosquito Abatement District, you know, they were telling me that, like, the droplets of adulticide they use are so small that they're, you know, smaller than the width of a human hair, you know, and they're like, you know, they formulated them to, when they fall from the sky, that they, you know, will hit mosquitoes and kill a mosquito, but if they happen to hit a beetle, you know, or something like that, it won't have a detrimental effect on them. But then, you know, I talked to, you know, sort of advocacy folks, you know, like Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. And, you know, somebody over there was saying that they just don't believe it. You know, there have been times in the past where the government tells us something is safe, and then it turns out years later that exposure to that thing was not good for humans. And so, you know, they would say they've been advocating that we just don't do this sort of at least adulticide pesticide spraying, because they fear that, you know, exposure to it, even, you know, even if you're not an inmate in the prison where you know, planes are flying over spraying you directly, basically, with these pesticides, that exposure to, you know, long-term exposure, any exposure, can have detrimental health impacts that are worse potentially than West Nile, which is ostensibly why you would spray for mosquitoes outside of just trying to stave off bites, you know, right. Like neurological diseases, you know, cognition, you know, problems and stuff like that. That's what they fear. Hmm. And they say, like, this idea that, you know, a pesticide could, you know, sort of selectively attack certain living things but not others is just a fallacy. So
And at the same time, and then, I mean, turning away from the fears that they have about people, there's also the fears of the conservation community about what mosquito abatement might mean for the ecosystem out there and for wildlife, you know, there in the wetlands of the Great Salt Lake. I guess tell us about that part of that. I you know, we think of mosquitoes as a nuisance, but are they also maybe, I don't know, a food source for a significant food source for certain creatures out there as well? Or are the concerns something else, Peyton?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, mosquitoes do play a role in the ecosystem out there. And by moving the prison into this ecosystem, this wetland ecosystem, they've kind of, you know, they've moved into a system that they were not a part of, and mosquitoes were definitely a part of. And so, yeah, some birds do eat these mosquitoes, but I talked to the, you know, the people who run like the duck clubs out there and those who are interested in the, you know, bird conservation and work for Audubon out there. And they're worried because they think that these pesticides may impact some of the other insects that are out there, like midges and stuff like that, that, you know, the birds do rely on kind of more than they rely on mosquitoes. And so that's what they're worried about, because it's like, you know, mosquitoes are an issue, but the mosquito abatement district doesn't spray for these other kind of nuisance insects that will probably be impacting the prisoners, like biting midges and biting deer flies, you know, and stuff like that. And so they're worried that, you know, once they've figured out maybe the mosquito problem, there will be increased pressure to spray for these other insects, and that in doing so, you know, mosquito abatement district's really good at abating mosquitoes, but, you know, have they really dialed in the pesticides and stuff like that to kill these other insects and try to have as little impact on the environment as possible? So that's what they're worried about. And I mean, for the most part, well, I mean, I guess I should just say the mosquito abatement district has told me that they haven't been asked to spray for these other types of insects yet, but it just kind of seems like, you know, eventually they will be, or there will be some kind of outcry to try to take care of these other insects too. Hmm. And then also, just not to mention, you know, when you're doing mosquito abatement, I mean, you know, if you're doing it on airplane, there's obviously, you're not necessarily walking through vegetation and stuff like that, but sometimes they do it via ATV or on foot and stuff. And so especially at Audubon, they're worried about, you know, having these crews come out there and, you know, walking through nesting areas, you know, and stuff like that, and just kind of disrupting the environment. So, you know, prior to the prison coming out there for a couple of years, they didn't have mosquito abatement, just because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a priority, and they had an agreement not to do it, but now they're having to do it again. So they're kind of worried about that.
Wow. I'm going to bring George Pyle, the editorial page editor, into this conversation, Peyton. And George, the thing I'm hearing, and it's too late to say, but it's doesn't seem like a good place for a prison.
No, I don't think it was ever a good place for a prison. It seemed to me that the legislature was interested in two things: vacating the old prison site at the point of the mountain so they could turn it into some new real estate development, and now they have ideas for it that really sound pretty nice, some kind of a think tank genius place. But maybe we should have built the genius think tank first so they could explain to us where to build the prison and how to handle this. I mean, I can't think about this. Everybody go to YouTube and search Monty Python Swamp King, where the other kings told me I was daft to build a castle on the swamp, but I built it just the same, just to show them. And it sank into the swamp. And then I built another one, and it sank into the swamp. And I built a third one. It fell over, burned down, and sank into the swamp. But the fourth one stayed up. Well, this is the first
iteration
of this. And part of the incentive for it, and I don't think anybody is hiding this, is you put this huge state facility out there, which the state taxpayers pay for. What was it, Peyton, $1 billion we wound up paying for this?
Yeah, it was $1.05 billion.
Yeah. But you build roads out there, you lay utility services out there, And that makes it easier and encourages development of some of that other land out there, which if you have a certain kind of thinking, I mean, it wasn't paved, therefore it was useless. And the fact that the birds use it and the mosquitoes use it and it's been there for a million years just piping along just fine without any human beings, and we think, well, we need to pave it over. We need to develop it because it's going to waste. Well, it's a swamp.
Swamp King, George. I like the Monty Python reference. We'll have to get there. Peyton, I'm afraid we're going to have to actually leave this story there. But at the moment, there's not spraying happening. And I mean, now it's winter, so it's probably not. These mosquitoes are basically largely dormant, I imagine. Do we know what happens next?
Yeah. So basically, yeah, you're right. The mosquito season is basically done at this point, and definitely last night's snow helped. But yeah, so they're going to try to figure out, you know, a contract, might have lawmakers involved in that process, because, you know, figuring out basically how to offset the mosquito abatement services so that Salt Lake City taxpayers aren't sort of footing that bill. And then, you know, doing some mosquito abatement things, you know, teaching staff at the prison how to put larvicide down themselves. Bug repellent available to inmates. And last I heard on that, it's still not there. It's back ordered, and there is hope that it will be there before next season. So even that's a question mark right now. So we shall see.
Okay. That's Peyton Harkins, who is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We shall wait and see. We're going to take one quick break in the show and come back with underplayed stories of the week. I guess maybe I'll make coyotes my underplayed story since we are low on time and I planned on talking about that. But behind the headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, coming back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Peyton Harkins, and George Pyle. And, you know, actually, just because we have only a couple of minutes left, I thought, Brian Maffley, I might try and quickly squeeze in your story about coyotes. This is a story about killing contests that happen in the fall. Maybe just tell us about these contests. What are they all about? Where did they originate?
Yeah, they've been around for a while, and they're fairly controversial among, you know, the wildlife community, who feel like they kind of devalue wildlife and make hunting look kind of bad. There's coyotes, of course, in the West are not. They have no protection at all. The wildlife agencies don't manage them. There's no season on them. You can shoot them whenever you feel like it. You don't need a hunting license in Utah to do that, maybe in other states. What makes Utah different is the state offers a $50 bounty for every set of coyote ears you bring in.
Why is that?
It's because a law was passed 10 years ago to set aside $500,000 for that purpose in the name of protecting mule deer. And the law is not very well grounded in science. There's not a lot of evidence out there that killing coyotes is going to make any difference, especially killing them indiscriminately. But the idea is that if we reduce the number of coyotes, more mule deer fawn will survive. That's the thinking. It's
I encounter coyotes occasionally on hikes, and I'm wondering, do they take down mule deer? Is that a thing that they do?
Oh yeah, they take down, you know, sick and old mule deer. It would be very difficult for them to take down a healthy adult, but they do eat the fawns for a limited part of the year. The fawns are vulnerable to that depredation. And
Brian, we're so low on time. I shouldn't have asked another question. Maybe what I'll ask you to do is to, you know, I know this is sort of a sport, basically. Yeah. People go out and kill a bunch of coyotes. There are people who are not happy about that.
They're particularly not happy that bounties are being paid on coyotes killed in these contests. It makes it look like the state is supporting them in some ways, and so the look isn't that good.
Okay, there's so much reporting of Brian's that you can find at sltrib.com on this, and I'm sorry we didn't save time for it, Brian. My apologies, but check it out, sltrib.com. For now, though, we are going to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Brian, I mean, you could keep going with this one if you want to, as your pick for underplayed story, or do whatever you want to do. Yeah,
my underplayed story is the one that Robert Gerke wrote about the Qatari government paying for Attorney General Reyes' trip to the World Cup over the Thanksgiving holiday.
Well, yeah, it's a really interesting pick. And I think, George Pyle, I know that at one point that was maybe going to be your pick as well.
That's okay. We didn't plan this out on that. There's another Sean Reyes story about how he's going after some investment fund because there's this investment fund that actually cares about the future of the world, and he thinks that's a bad thing. So that's another knock on Sean Reyes. And also, I read, you know, in the wild, coyotes actually run faster than roadrunners.
I did not
know. So my whole childhood was a lie.
It was an Oh, that's great. Thanks, George, for that pick for Underplay Story, including the fact, the little unknown fact about coyotes. Peyton Harkins, let's bring you in. I will also draw direct people to the fact that Sean Reyes had his tickets, airfare, and lodging paid for by the government of Qatar to go to the World Cup, supposedly because he was at some point a sort of security analyst for that government. Anyway, Peyton Harkins, I'll give you the final say for Underplay Story of the Week.
Oh, wow. Okay. So my underplayed story of the week is the police shooting story that Colby Peterson did on November 30th on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Basically, it was a police shooting that happened on I-15 and it shut down traffic for a long time. That might be why people noticed it. But what I thought was interesting about this story, in addition to the fact that it's a police shooting, is that it was the 18th this year. And I've been covering police shootings in Utah, you know, for two-ish years now, and 18 is kind of a low number to have at this time of the year. We've been averaging about 30. So I think that's a trend to pay attention to.
Wow, great pick, and interesting, especially given the context and your understanding of it. Peyton Harkins, thanks very much for that. With that, our show is coming to a close. This program is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and is heard all across the state on Utah Public Radio. I guess I should thank our guests, Peyton Harkins, Brian Maffley, and George Pyle. Thanks to all of you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you, Brian. Thank you very much to all. And you can find podcasts of this show and all of our programs over at kcpw.org. Next week, tune in for more of this. Guest host Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio will be filling in and bringing you up to speed on all of the future week in Utah news that's about to happen. Thanks for tuning in, and join us again next week.